Hello, I'm Melissa from Rock the Cotswolds and welcome to our brand new podcast, Meet the Rockers. Rock the Cotswolds was set up 4 years ago to show the rest of the world the outstanding creativity and talent we have in this beautiful part of the world. So for anyone who thought the Cotswolds was just red cords and duck races, listen on. Every month on our website, rockthecotswolds.com, we showcase five rockers, a person, place or thing you wouldn't expect to find in these rolling hills. Today we're meeting rocker and inventor Tom Lawton. His numerous works have led the way, including the Million Mile Light that runs on our kinetic energy and lasts for 300 years, no less, and his latest masterpiece called Uplift, which is a soothing piece of sculpture that instills calm into stressful lives. He tells us about his ideas, Bacon Alarm Clock, anyone, his path to success, being kicked off the QVC channel for his cheek, and tips for budding inventors. Big thanks to Tom and Rock the Cotswolds' main sponsor, National Accountants, Crowclerk, Whitehill in Cheltenham. Their belief in our campaign keeps us alive and kicking. Here's Tom. So, Tom.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. What has been the highlight of the last 6 months for you?
The highlight of the last 6 months? It's 8 months since I was on holiday.
Is
so
it?
I suppose that would have been the highlight, but yeah, no. I've had a project, and I kind of live for my projects, and it's, in a way, the actual doing of things is the only thing I can ever guarantee.
Yeah.
I never know what the outcome is going to be, but if I can enjoy the work, then that's where I get most of my love from. And I've had a project that came out of nowhere about 8 months ago, and I've put every bit of my heart and soul into it for 6 months. So that's been my highlight, yeah. In a funny way, working. Bizarrely, but it's not been a paid job. It's been a working in the evenings, and the family at home watching telly, and I'm just scribbling away in my sketchbooks, and I love it.
So is this your new project here?
It is.
Okay, so
yeah.
I've got it in front of me. Am I allowed to touch it?
Yeah, of course.
Here we go.
I mean, they're quite delicate, but
it's beautiful. So how would you describe it?
I would describe it as something that's quite uplifting.
It is, and it's made of wood and glass and some, is that metal at the bottom?
It
there?
Is, yeah. There's a, it's a very clever little solar engine, which a friend of mine has invented, essentially. So it's a collaboration with a very clever friend of mine up in Shropshire, and he showed me this delicate little solar powered engine that he had created over the last year, and showed it me in the summer, and it just ignited my imagination, because I could see it working so well with a spiral shape helix form.
Yeah.
So I've taken it on, and I've just laboured my love over it, and made this lovely kinetic sculpture, basically. So when the sun shines, it captures its energy and it turns it into a spiral, this flowing motion. And it's, do you know, my big struggle is finding ways to meditate and finding ways to keep myself really calm. My head can often be in all sorts of places, and I over the years I've used running as my means to meditate, and that's one hell of an energetic way to relax, actually. And so you can do it in the washing up. Meditation is here for all of us. You don't need any special skills, but it's just trying to find ways that inspire me to stop thinking. And we made one of these things. I call it Uplift, and we found it so satisfying to look at that I just thought, I've got to make that happen.
Yeah.
And so I've sort of literally, here in front of me, there are three
sketchbooks
that I just like full of everything.
Is it still your secret design?
Yeah, I mean, you can just see it's almost like a stream of consciousness. That
it's
when
very
I
neat.
I suppose so. I'm quite technical, so I suppose my drawings can look a little bit polished sometimes, but then there's plenty of scribbles in there too. So yeah,
and
it's almost
all
like
the workings out, and how it's actually going to
all the workings
spin.
Out. So it's like my work becomes my great obsession. But the reason to go back to your question,
yeah,
the reason this has been the most the highlight of the last 6 months is because it's in pursuit of beauty. I just want to make something that's beautiful. It's not actually doing anything clever or functional. It's not a widget to save you energy or
keep
or,
you calm.
Just to keep you calm, and I really like that.
And before that, you've got the Million Mile Light.
Yes.
Is that right? And that came from running.
Yes,
it?
Totally. Yeah, that was.
Here it is.
Yeah, that. I mean, that's talking of highlights of the last 6 months. It's very satisfying when you finally get a product into production, and we've just had these delivered now with our first backers. This is my second generation Million Mile Light.
Yeah, this
so
is
I launched
great.
In 2015, and you know, there's always a backstory of a few years of development, because that's how long it tends to take with any particular project. But this was inspired, the Million Mile Light was inspired by my love of running. I was running the trails 3 or 4 years ago and was imagining, wonder if I could use the energy that I expend when I run to make light that would keep me safe. And the sun was setting, so I was almost racing against the setting sun. And the answer was, yes, I can. And I launched the first version a couple of years ago on Kickstarter, which was really successful.
Yeah.
And then having done that, and lots of runners around the world have got them, which is great, it seemed obvious that I wonder if I could make it even more sensitive so that kids could wear them. And being really mindful of having children of that age where they're walking to school.
Yeah.
And I also have, most of my work comes through some sort of observation or experience and that I've encountered, and it's almost my philosophical expression to the world is how I've dealt with that experience, and then they manifest themselves as ideas or inventions. When I was at school, a very good friend of mine's sister was killed in our village in November. It was bonfire night, and it was a little rural Wiltshire village, and she simply wasn't seen by the cars because we don't have the pavements in every part of the villages, and often the hedges are high. And I remember it, and Helen was such an inspiration. It feels like the wrong word to say, but the story was so profound that somewhere in my mind I've logged that.
Yeah.
So when I did the Million Mile Light the first time, it seemed obvious that I make it work for children.
Yeah.
So we've made it hypersensitive. We relaunched it on Kickstarter, and I've had support from an organisation called the Safer Roads Foundation. So we're providing free lights to school children in a school in Wootton Bassett, and also Wiltshire Council have got behind it as well. So they're just about to do free lights for lots of children in rural villages around Malmesbury, which is really good.
Will it
good.
Branch out?
And it will, hopefully, yeah. I mean, you like all these things, you want to start with little steps.
Yeah.
I'm determined not to fail in this. So I'd rather go slowly and build it. And the thing with doing something for kids is you can never assume that they're actually going to wear it. So it's all very well to go, well,
but
this
they
is what
keep
I
keep it on their bag, so it's not as if they're even going
to
notice.
No, exactly. Yeah. Hopefully they will, but you almost don't want to scale up to make hundreds of thousands of them. Let's put a few thousand out there.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's watch them. Do they use them? Are they the right colours? Do
also
they?
So with kids, it's like a Me Too thing, isn't it? If they see them on their friends,
well, hopefully
then they want one.
Hopefully, exactly.
I think they will.
Yeah, but it's a lovely project, and it's great to have that to come to fruition. And with that, because I was doing the kids' version, I wrote a book for it called Let's Walk to School to I suppose inspire more journeys by foot. That's
absolutely. And back to the grown-ups, so people like me that may not be the fastest runners in the world, doesn't matter, does it?
No, it doesn't matter at all.
You have to be speeding.
No, but they genuinely work. I mean, for a couple of years we lived just outside of Malmesbury, and we'd do this treacherous walk into town. We rented a cottage in a beautiful village next door to town, but to get to town I'd have to walk one of the main pavements.
Yeah.
And every time I'd walk it I'd find myself saying some very loud expletive because a wing mirror would be 6 inches from the back of my head, and I'd think, oh my god, one of these days I'm going to be hit. And just wearing the lights, and they work to be clear to the listeners, they work off your kinetic energy, so as you move they harness that energy and they turn it into light that keeps you very visible to about 200 meters, and it's just a pulse that would let people know you're there. And they work so well that a car will see you from a couple hundred meters, and it will just, they tend to just take 10 miles an hour off their space and move themselves half a meter away from the pavement. So drivers do have empathy for pedestrians, but only if they can see them. If they can't see them, how would they possibly know?
Absolutely.
So it really does work well. And funny enough, I have a real test of it this evening, because my eldest son, who's 10, wants to walk to Scouts. And this evening, Scouts is in a nearby village in the middle of a field. And so I've thought, oh my goodness, and I know the clocks have just gone back, but it will be dusk then. So I'm like, right,
you're
well,
setting
that's
him
a,
off with this.
I mean, I've got it. If I don't trust it to work, then
no.
It's just more a case of trusting him, and I do that. So,
these two are your babies at the moment.
These two are my babies. It's the Million Mile Light and this Project Uplift, and the theme that's shared between them, which is something that will almost I'll do with everything that I do from this point forward, is designed for longevity. So it's planned endurance as opposed to planned obsolescence.
Which is totally in keeping with what everyone's talking about at the moment.
It has to be. I mean, the Million Mile Light's made of plastic, and it's funny, plastic's become like this really dirty word at the moment.
Mm.
It's actually an incredible wonder material. It's so amazing. We wouldn't use it in the way that, in the inventive and different ways that we do, if it wasn't such an incredible form. It's about using it wisely. So to me, if you're going to use plastic, make it worked with a product that's got an incredibly long life to it.
Absolutely.
So the Million Mile Lights will last about 300 years, what? Which is just insane. Well, we don't know. I mean, it's
so it's a business model.
this is the tricky thing. Yeah, it's so business as usual doesn't want things that last forever.
No.
This is the struggle.
But
things are waking up. But it's difficult. Yeah, absolutely. So I've sold 30,000 Million Mile Lights over the last couple of years to runners directly.
Mm.
And the thing I'm most proud of with that is that I've had, I think, less than 10 failures.
Wow.
So if you were making scones, you'd burn more than burn more than 10 every 30,000 or something. So the diligence of our production and engineering is brilliant, and I kind of learnt the hard way to get that all right. But they last so long. So runners love them. We've been Runners World Gear of the Year, and we won the Running Awards last year, which is great. But retailers don't want to stock them.
Because?
They last too long. Oh, so a retailer would make more money selling something a bit cheaper with a bit more margin for them that was throwaway.
Yeah.
And that's the great struggle that we found.
Yeah.
So that, but I think that retailers waking up to that as well. I think that consumer pressure is all part of what's needed in order to change the goalposts in terms of being a little bit longer term about things. I think that there's so much that the world suffers from in through short termism, whether it be politics or be it business. But I'm a long term thinker, and that's what I
Absolutely.
That's why I and it, to me it's just a common sense approach to solving a problem. Why wouldn't you make it last as long as possible? But
exactly, because you love everyone, Tom. That's why.
Oh well.
But also, there are enough people in the world, aren't there, that you can have one each. Well, this is it.
Exactly. So, and if I think of this as this is what I'm excited about at the moment with the Let's Walk to School product and campaign, is that there's a fresh crop of kids who start school every single year.
Absolutely.
So my goodness, there's a market that will keep growing. So
and you take it through your whole life, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. You? And you'll lose them.
Yeah.
So that's all right.
Can run little people.
Exactly.
So these two, and then before this, was it the Bubble Picks that you had?
Bubble Picks was my. It wasn't my first, but it was certainly the one that's.
I think that's when we met you about 4 years ago.
Definitely.
I remember
at
the launch party. Yeah. You got it with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I, do you know, that started in 2001. So I was, I think it started, if I was looking really at the legacy of it, I reckon it had its first kind of kernels of inspiration in the Cotswolds. I've grown up in a village next door to Castle Coombe. Do you know Castle Coombe?
Yeah.
It's it's a step back in time.
Yeah.
It's so picturesque. I mean, it's good enough for Spielberg to come and set his Hollywood studios up in the village because they couldn't recreate it in Los Angeles. So Coombe's amazing. And I grew up in a little village next door called Yatton Kennel. None of us, I don't think we knew anybody who had a house in the village because they're all so incredibly beautiful and owned by Hong Kong bankers and second homes and stuff. But the it's a stunning part of the world, and we used to go there. We used to work in the pub, and it was equidistant for me and my friends who lived in local villages, and we'd all meet in the market cross on our bikes, and we'd sit there and we would observe coach loads of Japanese tourists arrive. Now this would be in the late 80s, early 90s, so we would be young teenagers, and these coaches would arrive, and we would kind of just people watch and interact with everybody. But the thing we noticed about the Japanese was this almost like automated robotic approach to taking photographs. They'd come out the coach, the camera would come in front of the face, they wouldn't interact with the locals, and they'd walk around taking pictures. And it was almost like the camera was their blinkered field of view. And but Castle Coombe is such a panoramic place, and I would observe them and just wonder, well, it'd be amazing if you took the camera away from your face and kind of came and said hello to the locals. But it was my first observation of how people behaved en masse as consumers with cameras, and I suppose that was all part of the realisation that we're conditioned by the blinkered frame of a camera. And then I travelled to India a few years later, and I wondered, oh my goodness, I wonder what would happen if you widened that field of view to encompass everything. And I was inspired to develop a handheld 360 camera in 2001, and this was before I'd seen camera phones, before the iPod, so it was quite a jump of imagination, and I put about 15 years into developing my own 360 degree camera solutions, and actually really was a pioneer of the whole 360 video space, yeah. which has kind of grown, certainly blown up now. There's lots of companies involved. A lot of the work I did has directly inspired people like Samsung and the kind of the footprint of the products and concepts that I was working on have all been developed by or all inspired other startups. So yeah, I suppose it started in the Cotswolds, and Bubblescope was definitely a labour of love for me, as these things always are, because nobody pays you to be an inventor.
No. I was going to say, actually, so when I was I lived abroad and I came back and I moved in back in with my parents, and I had all these ideas, these inventions, and my dad's eyes would be rolling, but you can have all these ideas, but where do you go with it? And so I was wondering, do your parents, so you started these thoughts from very young.
Yeah.
Did your parents encourage you to develop them?
Absolutely. My parents were amazing encouragers, and in fact they're the reason, I suppose, I am who I am and I do what I do. At the same time, there's a measure of pragmatic, not cynicism, but they're both from, my mum and dad are both from the West Midlands, and so they've got a certain dry humour look at things, and so I can be quite flighty with my head, and I can easily feel like, oh, I'm being brought back down to earth, but particularly by my dad. But it's not the case. It's just a different, just a slightly more, have you really thought about that, Tom?
Yeah.
And but
which is
actually
good, isn't it?
Oh, which is great. Yeah, yeah. absolutely. And my dad was a self-taught jazz musician. So if you imagine jazz as a very free-form, creative means of expression, brilliant inspiration to have dad, and having taught himself. Wasn't like there was a path that he had to go down. There was no structure. He's somebody who's gone on his own journey in that respect. But he was an aerospace engineer as well. That was his job. So in terms of diligence and highly technical approach to problem solving, dad's always had that. But as a family, we've always been quite just creative in terms of being open-minded to ideas. Yeah. I think that's one of the most important things. People can often talk themselves out of a good idea.
Yeah.
So you can often you have to be somebody who wants to build things up, as opposed to build yourself down.
Yeah.
I think that's you have to naturally encourage your own ideas, for sure.
But how, if so, say you start, I've got a brilliant idea. And I have no engineering background, and I know nothing about IT.
Yes.
Where do you go with that? Because obviously the biggest fear is that you tell someone and then they nip off and they do it themselves. So how would you encourage someone?
I certainly don't ever allow that bit of fear to come into it. I'm very careful about not exposing an idea too widely through social media, because of course there's all sorts of people who could just nick an idea, and they tend to. But in terms of immediately getting feedback, no, that's the first thing to do. So overcome that. The person you'll... Pick the right people, of course. Pick a friend. Don't just start randomly chatting to somebody on the train. But you need feedback. And if an idea exists in isolation in your own mind, it can become incredibly distorted and probably won't find its path forward. Everybody has to share things in this world. And it's almost like you're... if you have an idea, you're probably in pursuit of trying to solve a problem. And the most important thing is to become expert on that problem that you're trying to solve. And that won't just be yours. And by sharing an idea, by talking to somebody who might be experiencing that problem, who might be part of a potential market, a potential customer, somebody who might just get it, appreciate the frustration, share it with them. And then the idea starts to gain a little bit of inertia on its own. And I suppose... And it's free at this point, right? Mm. It's just an idea. So it doesn't belong to you. It doesn't belong to anybody else. And I really believe that to this day, that everything that I've ever created, no matter what risks I've done and how much I've put into it, and despite the fact I might have been years ahead, none of it belongs to me. I don't believe that. I think that would be my ego telling me it's mine. Actually, we all exist at the same time. We have the same frustrations, the same inspirations. So yes, you're clever having that idea, but you're not genius for having it.
No.
There's someone else in the world who's got the same thinking as you,
so
and
it's
someone else.
The parts together.
So it's but at the same time, you've got to tread carefully if you want to genuinely do this and have some sort of reward to you for doing it. So you will have to at some point protect your idea, but go about it in a trying to solve the problem in the best possible way. And really, you'll find the things that you don't have. I've never had all of the skills and the kind of the map to get to where I want to get to. But because I've had such a desire to get there, or solve that problem, or find or invent that thing, or create that thing that I feel like the world must need, that's what's driving me. It's not the fact that I have got the skills, it's the fact that I want to get to that destination. And I'll almost find the expert I need in this area of optics, or the expert I need in this area of electronics, or the person I need in that commercial area of business, and they will be specific to that project and that journey. But I certainly won't let the fact that I haven't got the money to do it get in the way. There's something else. There's something that it's a creative spirit. It's a someone said it to me recently. Creative people are like fruit trees. They're just going to keep bearing fruit. Every season comes, there's going to be more fruit. Now, the last thing you would want to tell a fruit tree is to stop producing fruit.
Yeah.
It would almost, well, I don't know what would happen to the tree, but creative people are like that. We always need to do it. But ideas are, they are, it's a terribly difficult journey to go upon, and there's so many unknowns in it. But I think there's an idea. It's like they say, there's a novel in everybody. I think there is an idea in everybody, but it doesn't mean you have to lead the whole thing yourself. You might just be part of that. It might be that you. Sometimes I have ideas, and I know it's absolutely not for me, and I'll just write a letter to the CEO of a particular company, and I'll say, I've had a thought of this. I'm not going to do it. There you go. And I'll almost just gift thoughts. It gets them out of your own head.
Yeah.
But the place to start is a conversation and a blank piece of paper, and just start to draw something out. And you'll see if that starts to build itself. And then at some point, you're going to have to put that into a practical form that proves whether it's going to work or not. So that's the first step into prototyping. And you can start there in the most primitive, basic ways possible. I've got prototypes that are made out of bits of Lego. There's all sorts.
On the shelf, I'm looking at an array.
Yeah, some work, some don't. Projects. Some are almost maquettes or models, or almost like this is a 360 camera. Right, but
it looks like something out of Star Wars.
I know. It also looks like a witch doctor's tool. I call it the Moon Man. I walked into BT Labs, who were almost like 15 years ago. They were like NASA, like Google would be now, really well funded, full of futurologists and incredibly clever people. And I wanted to slightly let them know that I wasn't from their world, but I was, as in the strictures of corporations and academia, but I was very imaginative, and I created this thing called the Moon Man. It's made out of cinnamon sticks and sea kelp and a wooden mushroom. Don't get me wrong, what would they have thought? I would have looked like some sort of warlord witch doctor wandering in. And it was almost an embodiment of imagine a camera that could see in every direction. And it was so fascinating. These people. Very, very bright people, all half of them PhDs. It was like a part of the sea. There were those who believed and thought, there's something about this guy. And there were those who just thought, what the
Get
fuck
him
is
out
he?
Of here.
What, excuse my French. What is he doing exactly? But I did make a very good friend of BT Labs through that project. And that's all you're looking to do sometimes, is spark people's imagination to see things or perceive you a little bit differently.
Yeah.
So they're all models and prototypes of 360 cameras or my recordable alarm clocks.
That was one of the first, was it?
That was the first, And that was just so simple. I remember, and I almost wanted to start at the beginning of the day. So I suppose I had a sense that I wanted to be an inventor, wanted to be an ideas person, and part of that is just wanting to live and love my life as my own creative journey. I've got my story to live, and of course I've worked for lots of other people here and there, but I've got something in me that wants to fulfil itself. And I remember, so everything's an experience. I remember while I was at university, I'd spend every summer working in a plant nursery. It's a place called West Kington, and I would cycle 7 miles in the morning, leaving the house at about 7:30, which was always 10 minutes too late, so the cycle was furious and frantic. But I'd get there half an hour later, up and down all those little Cotswold hills. But it was the first time I was having a relationship with my alarm clock, and I would dread it. That just the word alarm.
Yeah,
why would you shriek yourself into the day? Alarm yourself at the beginning of the day. It's just like so unfriendly. And you'd end up doing that thing where your circadian rhythm would actually wake you up before your alarm clock would sound,
sheer panic.
And you'd have disabled it, and then you'd oversleep, and then you'd be in even more of a panic. So the alarm clock was like, oh, this is an interesting place to start. I wonder if I could make that a little bit more pleasant.
And
I looked at every conceivable means of waking someone up that I could think of. So vibration or sound or smell. Smell was interesting. I genuinely,
well,
I was, I woke friends up when I was at university with bacon. So I had it cooked, of course, not sizzled elsewhere, and then the smell. And it was just all a bit weird. They probably actually woke up to the looming presence of me over them in the morning with a frying pan. So it wasn't
the actual
bacon. Exactly. You just thought, well, is that breathing I hear? What is going on there? Anyhow, bacon was...
Haddock?
No. Kip, that's right, kippers. No, you could do. That's right, for real deep sleepers. But no, the practical idea of having to reload your alarm clock every night with a brasher of bacon as well, it's a slightly odd thing. So there's probably an art project in it somewhere.
Yeah, but you need to write to a CEO.
Exactly. But I ended up thinking, well, here I am trying to imagine how people would want to wake up. And this is part of the you know, an intrinsic thing that always comes back to everything that I design is you've got all of your assumptions come in and then you have to take them all back. And the one that I took back was, I realised that sound was the way to wake someone up in a fun and entertaining way and to make it humorous or really pleasant. And then you think, oh, well, what sounds would it be? And then you go, no, why would I? Why should I predetermine what someone would think? Yeah. Let's make it have no sound, so we make it recordable, and therefore you choose. And so it's almost like you're trying to do something, and you go, I'm gonna remove myself from it, and let's make it as almost vanilla, as plain as possible.
Yeah.
So I invented the recordable alarm clock, and the idea
was
really
before anyone else.
It was before smartphones could do it. I think that at the time, answer phones had just started having little chip technology, so the technology was really new then as well.
Yeah.
And the premise was so simple that you have more imagination than a beep beep.
Yeah,
and then I liked the kind of almost the philosophical idea of wake up to yourself. And that's just a nice thing. I thought, okay, so you've got the imagination. It's your day. You choose. And that was really successful. So
and
I did that.
Where did you sell those? Was that through?
Well, I did that at the end of my degree, because if you do a product design degree, you spend a year designing one thing, and I did that project at the end of my degree in 1997, and all I wanted to do when I finished college was like, let's make that real. That's it. That's my purpose in life.
So what did you study? What was the plan?
I studied product design at Bournemouth University.
Yeah.
Had the most incredible third year because we got to work in industry, and I ended up going to Cape Town. I knew nothing. I mean, I wrote 70 letters around the world and I got 3 responses, and one was in Joburg. I took a job there. It was terrible. I then packed my bag, hitchhiked across the desert. I had about 300 quid left to my name and spent 3 weeks burning through that little bit of money, but found a job working in high-end virtual reality, building cities in VR for this incredible guy called Dr. Henk Goosen. And so I had this amazing year, but Mandela was president at the time, so it was such a place to be.
Yeah.
It was almost like a spiritual awakening for me as a person, because I realised what I could get done with just my own efforts and like no network, not knowing anybody. So it was very incredibly verifying, really, I suppose, that you put some effort into life and it rewarded you, and it taught me to think really independently, and or gave me confidence too. So when I finished college, had this idea of this recordable alarm clock, and all I thought was, that's my job, is to make that a reality. Yeah. And I worked for Lloyd's TSB, funnily enough, as a designer for them, based in Bristol, in order to support myself while I was doing that.
I was going to say, how did you fund it?
Well, that's it. This is always the struggle, isn't it? When I left college, my head was done in a bit with computers at that point, so my course was quite computer heavy, and I was a very mindful person at that age. I really was, and the way that my folks have supposed to brought me up, and with the way my relationships with my friends, we were really, really kind of like very balanced thinkers. And I just knew I needed a little bit of time away from the screens. And I went and worked in a golf course, and I was very happy to do that. But I was being paid £4.50 an hour, paying a patent attorney £150 an hour. So you take that first step on that ladder, and that's a long walk.
Yeah.
So to go from such little income, really, but I have just slowly climbed that
you had
ladder.
That belief, you knew
that's what you wanted to do.
You didn't give up.
And I could visualise myself in the position of having had these things successful. So, and that's such an important thing with any sort of ambition or goal, is to be able to visualise yourself actually reaching it. And of course, that's hyper important as a creative, as a designer, as an inventor. And I have tools to visualise, whether it be through a pencil or whether it be through high end. Computer generated imagery. I'm very good at visualizing things, but most importantly through your mind, the ability to tell yourself you can be successful, just because you might not know how to get there or know anybody else who's been been to that place. I think that you have to be able to, you have to give yourself some encouragement in your mind. If you don't, then you're never going to start.
And
at the same time, that is total blind faith. There is no surety to it. There's no guarantee that you're going to get there.
Well, did you feel that with crowdfunding? Because obviously you're known.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that crowdfunding is easy, but did you think, will this work? Will it not work when you're looking to get funded?
Totally, totally.
So you're just throwing it out there and I'm waiting for people to.
Yeah, absolutely. You crowdfunding is almost a discipline in itself. There has to be a really it's not like a casual wow, which just makes things magically happen. You have to strategically work a crowdfunding campaign. It's funny, with Uplift at the moment, I've just paused. I was about to go straight into a campaign and I'm taking a breather from doing it because I want to do everything possible to guarantee that outcome of success.
Yeah.
And also to go through the process without it being too stressful.
Yeah.
I like to try and enjoy what I'm doing. And sometimes, as an inventor, as you can imagine, that the jeopardy is so high. I mean, I live from feast to famine, and there are so many ebb kind of peaks and troughs to my career that I've learnt to become incredibly resilient. But only really because I'm constantly picking myself up.
Yeah.
And so it's creative projects are like fires. It's very easy to start fires. If you met 11-year-old Tom, he'd be very good at starting fires. In fact, I think he probably in the wrong place in the middle of the woods on a few occasions. But it's very easy to start these projects and go into them with all of the energy that you have. But to actually sustain a fire or a creative project is the challenge.
Yeah.
Is to actually, it's all great to go, hey, I've thought of this thing and hit like a firework, here it is, and put it out to the world. Actually nurture that into something that's sustainable and meaningful and is a business that might actually make you a living is the art to it all, in a funny way.
Absolutely.
But you asked a question which was to do with Wake You, and that was, where did I manage to sell it? And that was, so to go back to that, I licensed my first invention. I wasn't looking to do everything. These days I tend to be trying to do it all like a fool that I am, but I'm almost trying to build my own distribution networks, my own manufacturing supply chains. It's not like trying to be controlled, but it's trying to do things as well as possible. And but with Wake You, I think I realised that I wasn't going to do that, and I found a company who already had that pipeline in place. So they had their own distribution channels into retail, and they had their own manufacturing supply chains. So I licensed the idea to them. The recordable alarm clock went into a company called Rekaton. I'd spoken to half a dozen before who'd all turned me down. Everybody from Tomy to Swatch said, very nice, but no thanks, not for us. And this one company called Rekaton, who had a brand called Ross, they made headphones and alarm clocks, and they literally bit my arm off for it, and that was fantastic. So I had my first success, I suppose, in the slipstream of another company's infrastructure. But what you want as a young person, as any person, are things that give you confidence.
Yeah.
So Wakey didn't make me a great deal of money. Nothing has, really. But that's all right. That's all right. I'm not doing for that anymore. But it gave me the sense of, this is doable, and you can. Yeah, it was. They gave me everything. And 6 months later, I was. I remember so proudly presenting it live on QVC, which is actually
a channel, to be honest.
It's, do you know what? It's funny because I've done bits of telly since,
and I
can imagine that QVC in the is not looked at particularly highly by the BAFTA community. Who cares? No, exactly. It was the most real telly I've ever done because it was live, and you sit there, and if it's your invention, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I find it a stretch to enthusiastically pitch someone else's invention, but it was my own thing, and they turn the monitors to you, so as you're pitching, you see yourself, which is a bit weird, a bit disconcerting, but you've got this little counter in the bottom corner, and it tells you how many sales you've made as you're doing it.
Wow.
So as your patter goes well, you see the numbers start to go, and that's really, really quite cool.
So it did well on QVC.
I think I sold like 810 minutes or something, and which is probably pretty good. And I'd had three goes, and then I think they decided that they weren't going to let me back because I started to get slightly cheeky with it because it was live. I'd start slipping in things, not like double entendres or anything, but I'd start saying things that were not, I don't know, I'd like to say friends' names or pets or whatever. And the deal I had with my friends who I lived with, we all rented a vicarage just outside of Bath. There were 9 of us, and it was amazing. But if I could slip in a friend's name live on QVC, then they had to order one that minute. So, and I think that QVC got sharp to that.
Three goes and I was out.
But
yeah, but you've got that on your CV.
Yeah, exactly. I loved it. It's all on VHS somewhere, so I must dig it out.
Oh yeah. Now you were saying, obviously you had was it Channel 4? You had your programme and Barney, your son, was with you.
Yes.
That looked like an amazing experience. Was that fun?
That was fantastic. Yeah, that was such a baptism of fire. I'd done bits of telly before. I can't say that I ever had any wild ambition to do it. I never imagined I'd have my own show. But I think I'd filmed some Bubblescope stuff, and it was on YouTube. And then I was on the radar of somebody on Discovery. And then I filmed a pilot thing for them. And TV is all based in and around Soho and parts of London, and it's such a close network of people that everybody talks to each other. And I think I just ended up in a conversation between two different like a producer and an agent, and out of the blue I was approached by this agency in London on Charlotte Street, a company called Intertalent, who were then Raw, and they said, would you like to do telly? We think you could be great on telly, you know, we'd love to chat to you about it. And I said, I'm actually all right. I'm busy and I'm doing what I'm doing.
I'm inventing things.
Yeah, exactly. For God's sake. Yeah, I don't for you people. But my wife was pregnant with our second, and I came home and I said, oh, that's funny. The fact the blue, I was approached by an agent for telly, and she's like, right, go to London now. And because money's always been tight, she's like, no, we always need a second income.
So the voice of reason.
The voice of reason, exactly, which I always need. So Charlie inspired me to go and meet these people, and I met a lady called Miranda, who is my agent now, and she was fantastic. And what I'm not really into celebrity culture. I think that's the reason I was a bit cynical about telly, actually, was this idea. There's lots of amazing things within the media. There's lots of vacuous things that aren't so appealing, and often the best marketed stuff is not necessarily the greatest stuff we see. But I thought, actually, maybe there is a space for me there somewhere. And I, with Miranda, I went to meet Channel 4, and I mean, I must have been in some sort of frame of mind, giving off some sort of energy, because literally in that 45-minute meeting, I left and they said, right, well, you're commissioned.
And
we're on what mode?
QVC,
exactly, yeah, Sparkle. And, actually, I've been in West Wales, so I think I was just in a I don't care mode, but yeah, at the same time, I'm being completely positive. And they gave me a show, but it was really strange because they commissioned me as an individual and they said, well, and it will come out in September, but we didn't know what the show was going to be. So it was this really odd kind of us about face type approach to commissioning a show. And then they said, well, what are we going to do? And what they were looking for was a vehicle for me to introduce myself to the public. And what they were interested in was a way to engage the public with my infectious relationship with my imagination and invention, and this would just be a good thing. I wonder if it would inspire other families to be creative or whatever.
Yeah.
And so they said to me, we're looking for a vehicle, and I'm very literal, so I painted this marvelous moving house bus, and it was like a bus that was, I don't know, it was. I'll show it to you in a minute on the computer, but it was like a cartoon of a bus that was just full of so many inventions. It was unbelievable. And I sent this like huge canvas acrylic painted thing to the head of 2020, who were the production company that made it, and it blew their socks off. I didn't end up creating a marvelous house bus. I ended up making a fantastic floating home. Yeah. And it was almost it became a vehicle for the nation to get to know me a little bit. And it was it's very challenging because TV kind of wants more and more and more. And I said, well, we're not going to invent anything in this show. And they said, but of course we are. Well, you're an inventor. I said, but yeah, but if you listen to me, you'll understand that it's a very slow process.
Yeah.
And you're saying we want to film this in 6 months. And I think we should be inventive, definitely. But we might not invent something. It's not like creativity is not like a process where you just put this in and you're going to get that result.
Yeah.
It's a meandering thing, and there's luck involved, and there's all sorts of percolation that's involved that nobody ever appreciates. But every idea has been almost a few years in the making because of the time it's just taken to mull it over. And before you might have even started, turning the sketches into something real. And I said, we won't invent anything. And they said, oh, we will, Tom. And I said, okay, all right, so what are we doing? Three episodes, we'll do two things per show.
Yeah.
And they said, let's do six. And I was like, oh my God, you really don't get it. But somehow...
Somehow
we did it. But there was nothing in there that I patented afterwards or that was a truly an invention. But it was an inventive approach to...
It's a process.
It was a process and it was a brilliant...
Or at home, you know, you want to resolve an issue, you can do it yourself.
Totally. And it was great as well. It was very liberating to be doing stuff that I was then... Because normally with my projects... in order to justify the time that you're going to put into them, you have to have some sort of goal. You have to be some sort of commercial point to doing it. Otherwise, how would I possibly sustain this type of lifestyle? And so whether you're going to license it or you manufacture it or you sell it off to somebody, there has to be an end goal that allows you to keep it going. But it was quite liberating with the Channel 4 show that it was all just fun, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And so actually I didn't have to stress over any of it, and suddenly somebody was paying me to invent.
Yeah.
So it was a bust mental
as well.
And having a ball with Barney, yeah. And he loved it, and
he's got his own spin-off show now, I imagine.
I mean Barney, it was such a fantastic experience for him, and he was five coming six, and TV's a huge thing and culturally in our lives. And unless you've been involved with a TV show, you won't appreciate what the fourth wall is. The idea that there's a dimension to the story that nobody sees, and it's where all the producers and the cameramen and the TV people are. And TV is a constructed reality, and it's reflecting back to the world. Most people are looking at that reflection thinking, that's how life is. And it's not like that.
Mm.
People aren't that well preserved, suntanned, presented. They're not even that well talented and skilled and doing all the things. TV can make people look incredibly capable. And it concerns me in that respect, because I think I'm really into having the right role models and heroes in life, but I mean the right ones. And therefore, the ones that I know are people who are stories I genuinely know, or friends I know, or experiences I can relate to, and I know the detail, I know the warts and all. And TV puts a varnish over all of that, and I don't think it's actually
very...
And it's selective, and I don't think it's very good for the mental health of society, actually, because we build people up to almost be unreal. And there's like celebrities now that I've known or have followed, and I almost stop, because I'm like, you don't even make your Instagram feed. That's done by art directors, and the trouble is people think that that's real, and it's therefore they compare themselves to it, and they go, I'm not good at that.
Yeah.
And actually the best possible experience for Barney was that he at 5 or 6 years old he got to peer behind the curtain, and he got to see both sides to it. And I remember there was a time when we stayed on the boat, and he said something to me. And it was really quite astute. And he said, Daddy, I'm hungry. In the real world. And because he was there right on set, knowing that I could, that there was this world where I could pretend to be whatever the producers want me to be. But no, actually, I'm genuinely hungry. And I need to say that I'm genuinely hungry. And it was like, oh, you've got it. You get that there's this disparity at that age. So I think it's done him. They are incredibly astute, of course, kids are. But I think it did him nothing but a favour. And it's part of why I've not just jumped on and done another show. You would start to be offered all sorts of things, and I realised that the things I'm being offered would water down my character, or I would be having to fake things. And I can't do that. I can't pretend that I can't show myself on TV doing something that I can't actually do. I don't know what it is in me, but my whole body...
Ethics.
I think it is ethics, but everything in me turns against it. It's like I would not be natural doing a cooking show for you unless it was Bodget cheese toasty cooking show. Then actually sandwiches. I'm a master of sandwiches.
Or bacon in the morning.
Or bacon in the morning. That's right. Bacon alarm clocks. I'm very good at them.
That's a new program. I think. Yes,
exactly.
On your own. But you were talking before about Castle Coombe. So the Cotswolds, obviously,
yes.
The Cotswolds is very important in that aspect. Has it inspired you? Do you find it an inspiring place to work?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely adore the Cotswolds. Do you know, funny though, I don't think I think only recently, perhaps almost only since Rock the Cotswolds have actually, I don't know, made me aware of the image of the Cotswolds in a different way. I never used Cotswolds to describe where possibly I was from. In fact, I wouldn't tell people I was from the Cotswolds.
Oh, really?
Because of I would always say West Country, and I'd always say I'm a Somerset boy in a wheelchair lad, But then I've been in the Cotswolds for like, well, my folks have been here for 25, 30 years, and I've been here for 15. But I suppose there was this connotation that it was all farrow and ball and all well to do and everybody up in North Cotswolds chipping cannon. The kind of, I don't know, that picture of
that
the
image,
that image, yeah, of that well to do kind of, you know, yeah, it's all yeah, everybody's got a Range Rover and whatever.
Red,
and I just red track, yeah, exactly. I'm so far removed from that. And do you know what's funny as well? Of all the years I've lived out in the sticks, out in the countryside here, I've never seen a hunt. I've seen people in red trousers, but I've never seen that, those classic Cotswold kind of images, of like the people must have the idea that everybody's like that, and it's not
in 15
like,
years.
Exactly.
So what made you move here then?
It's adorable. It's the pace. It's just life is gentle and it's beautiful, and I love nature. That's really it. But there's something about the stone as well. So my brother's a dry stone waller, and he does many things, but he, one of those things is dry stone
wall. That's a skill.
It is a skill. Yeah. It's a meditation as well, actually. It's because it happens so slowly, and you have to, there's enough thought, but not too much thought. And you tend to be doing it somewhere beautiful. But the, so we've fallen in love with the stone, I've lived in Malmesbury for 15 years, but actually I've been in the Cotswolds since I was about 12. And so I've camped in the forests, and I've known the valleys and the fields and the cider and all of it. I just adore it. It's the landscape. It's beautiful. It's who I am, and it's where I'm from. And the rest of the world is in a funny race, chasing its own tail. Yeah. And I know that we have to have a commercial, you know, you don't exist without money being part of your world, and it's so important to do that. And I'm not dissing the other parts of the Cotswolds either, as I've got to know this incredible region. It's just beautiful throughout, and in fact, it's even funny. You get someone that would appear to be quite well to do, like Cirencester, even, but then you've got like shows like This Country Have Been Made in there that are just actually doing a brilliant service to say it's not what your preconceptions were. And funny enough, my childhood was like This Country. Yeah. It's more similar to that than it is anything, really.
But you and Daisy and Charlie, who make the programme, are proof that actually with that lifestyle, this is what I'm going to be telling my kids in 10 minutes time. You have that creativity, don't you? Because you haven't got all the stimulation that you would have probably in a big city. So you're freer.
Totally. And you're, the freedom for us was incredible as kids. And the fact that there's such little distraction and relatively little going on. So I wouldn't be an inventor. My brother wouldn't be a dry stone waller and a musician, and my sister she now lives in India, but she runs a jungle camp. But she's totally self-made, and she wouldn't have that gumption if we. I don't know. There's something about having a slightly bored childhood in a funny way.
Yeah.
So you're left to your own devices. Yeah. So we would invent games all the time. I mean, when I was 15. I would have probably only talked to you about Maharabat, which was our game with a tennis ball and a very particular triangle piece of wall above my mum and dad, next to my mum and dad's bedroom window. But we would like play tournaments, and there's nothing going on in Yatton Kennel, little village in northwest Wiltshire.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't, but you make your own entertainment. And we'd also be quite mischievous as well. As we were kids growing up, we were known very well by the local police. Because we would... No, it's all right. We'd just be up to nothing malicious, but just camping and probably the wrong places and a bit of hijinks, a bit of, I don't know, to accidentally pick the wrong strawberries from the wrong field. But there was a really edgy armed police presence around Castle Coombe when I grew up, because Tom King used to be based near there, and he was the Northern Ireland and Defence Secretary. So there was this, he was number two on the IRA hit list.
Yeah.
So really bizarrely, the terrorist police were there, and they had nothing to do because there were no terrorists. And so we were slightly mischievous kids camping, and we were more interesting to them than anything else.
So if we
had the dogs out, we had the helicopters out, I've been chased by 4x4s with vehicle-mounted spotlights. there's a brilliant book that will be written one day.
There is.
When I get around to actually writing it. Or a series, maybe. No, it's true, but you watch something like This Country, and I kind of go, That totally. But it was actually more ridiculous than this. And yeah.
They've toned it down. I think also from, you know, I've got friends in London who look at it and they love it. But I think when you're living, it's even funnier, isn't it? Because you know about the steam fairs and all the things that are happening. Have you what happens here in Malmesbury? What do you have as your local event?
We do have a carnival every September. And in fact, I'm a judge of the carnival, which I adore.
Yeah.
So I go down and I have a special rosette that says I'm a judge.
Yeah.
And I take it really seriously, but not. And I give prizes to people who are who found ways to smuggle booze onto their floats. So if they're, but without the children seeing. So hip flasks. Oh, that's quite obvious. But if you've got something discreetly hidden in a pillow or whatever. I remember the late there was a lady in bed, and there was the cast of Hello Hello who were one, and René had something hidden in his hip flask or something. I don't know. There are just lovely characters everywhere, and yeah. I adore the. I can walk anywhere in Malmesbury, and I just have a friendly, warm response from everybody. It doesn't mean everybody's like asking about my business. I've never been into. No, I kind of hate cliques, that idea that everybody knows what you're doing, but then you just don't tell everybody what's going on in your life and all the little details. So you know, you
it's a quite open feel, isn't it? You could say hello, or if you're in trouble, you know, you could knock on any door.
I think what I like is that I think people genuinely look out for each other's well-being. So I think that you people will ask, how are you doing, and it's not a it's not just lip service.
Yeah.
There's actually a meaningful intent to it, and I'll know how people are. And I promise you, my spiritual guru, he used to be my postman and would come and visit me in the office here. Now there isn't a sorting office in town, so he's now a window cleaner, and I would say he's letting light into people's lives, which is what he's doing. But I don't know him in a sense of, I've never sat and had a drink or been for dinner or we've caught up properly, but I know him so well on these lovely little interactions and moments that we'll have had through the seasons, through the years, and he's looking out for me and I'm looking out for him. Same with the butcher, the same with the lady, the young girl who's opened the flower shop. I don't know them deeply, but neither are the relationships trivial, and I find that for me, having grown up in quite a small rural community in South Somerset, I like the fact that I feel warmth and love towards people who I don't really know. That's the world I want to live in, and the Cotswolds is a place where that's still happening. And Malmesbury is lovely because it's a working town, so it's not. As I say, it's not all second homes, and it's not well to do, and it's not people are here because they're living here.
And generations, I guess, have lived here.
I guess so. Yeah. So you do tend to find, there is that sense of, absolutely. It's totally. And so you find, in fact, it's funny. You get like initiatives. I think it's brilliant. Like in Frome, there's a place called the Library of Things, and it's a brilliant thing that should be in every town. And it's basically like saying, not everybody needs every thing. You don't. You might need a stepladder once a year. So why do you need to own one? There should be one in the town that's accessible to everybody. And so they have this Library of Things. In a funny way, a place like Malmesbury, it's such a genius idea. You know, who needs an actual lawnmower?
Yeah.
You only need it once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a really good thing. Now, I think that somewhere like Malmesbury, that's kind of happening unofficially anyhow, because people are neighbourly and they just know people and will be lending stuff here and there. Do you know, it's funny, there's one of the kind of the hippest new things coming out of Scandinavia, which seems to be somewhere that the trend watchers in London kind of look to for influence. There's forever a new Scandinavian lifestyle movement that we should adapt. The chances are that very thing that East London or hip London is looking at, saying, hey, this is the new cool thing, it's probably already happening in a provincial town somewhere here. So there's a thing in Sweden at the moment called plogging. I don't know if you've heard of plogging.
No.
It's basically jogging while you pick up litter. Now, the Abbey Flyers in town in Malmesbury, it's what they do on a Sunday.
Do they?
Yeah, they just do it, and they've been doing it. They haven't given it a cool name, it's just what they do, because they're people who are invested in the well-being of their area and the community, and so we just haven't branded it in a hip way. And I actually, that's what I really like about Malmesbury as well, is that there's nothing hip about it.
There's no trend,
there's nothing cool, there's not one shop that looks down on you if you walk in there. It's funny though, because this is my experience, so I say there's no snobbery here, and I might chat to someone else and they say, oh my god, there is. So you know, compared to Chippenham or whatever, I'm sure, but I tell you what I don't ever do is I never lock my bike. I've never locked my bike. I don't own a bike locked, and mind you, my bike does have a skateboard mounted to
was
the crossbar. That's for the school run. So I balance the balance, not both boys, and it can only be the little one now because the big one's too big.
Yeah.
But I balance little Rufus on the skateboard, and that's how we go to school. But I had this a few years ago. I remember parking my bike on the high street by the summer cafe, and you know, when you were a child, you used to do that thing. If your bike didn't have a stand, you get to a curb and you kick the pedal, and the pedal flips around and locks onto the curb. Exactly. So and then it self stands itself. So I just went up town and I kicked my pedal, and my bike self standing, and I walked off. And that's very matter of fact. That's just putting my bike there. I didn't think about it. And a guy came up to me and said, "Oh my goodness." Said, "I haven't seen that since the 1960s. And I was like, "What? Really? Do you watch?" I said, "What?" So just someone leave their bike with it and not even look back to it. And I said, and it made me think, "Oh my goodness, I've gotten used to the fact that this town is so, I don't know, so special and so safe, and that people wouldn't nick my bike." And this guy hadn't seen it for a while. Now, if you were in a local town, you might, you know, in Bristol, my bikes have been nicked in Bristol. I've had 3 bikes nicked when I lived in Bristol. If I was in Chippenham, it would be nicked. You know, there's certain little pockets of these beautiful Cotswolds that things are almost in a slightly different.
It's always like 6 degrees world. Of separation, aren't, because you always know someone who'll know that person who's done it.
Totally.
So at some point they'll be. They'll be caught.
Absolutely. So we had a Christmas fair in December, and the high street's closed down. It's all pedestrianised, and there's lots of little stalls. And I was selling my Million Mile Lights, very, very kind of off the cuff. Suddenly thought I'd put up a little pop up shop and did that. And I left my bike on the high street, and I came back to bring my stock I hadn't sold back to the office, and I got distracted here for an hour, and I thought, oh no, I must go and get my bike. It's on the high street, and I walked back to get my bike. This is just only a couple of months ago, and my bike wasn't there, so it'd gone. Now, the emotion I was feeling was only excitement. Was just all I thought was, if someone's nicked it, that's brilliant, because it's going to come back to me, and I'm fascinated to know who they are why they nicked it, and what they think that, and whether they thought they're genuinely going to get away with it.
Yeah.
There's only 6,000 people in the town, so the word will spread. You've got Tom's bike, but actually, I knew that it was just a reassuring experience. I got home, and by the time I got home, there was already messages on my Facebook, from people I know, to tell me that my bike had been recovered and put inside a particular shop, and someone was looking after it for me. And so it's a lovely part of the world.
No, it really is.
Yes, but don't move here, because the house is already expensive enough.
Anyway, keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
And where would you go for, not necessarily Marsby, where would you go for a pint? Where would be a great place to
have
a drink?
Oh, absolutely anywhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be it. I mean, it's a I've got favourite. My favourite brewery is a Cotswold brewery called Wickwar, and anywhere that was serving their beer. I don't know why they sell them in Co-op now. I know that they sell them in Waitrose, but every now and then I'll find a bar that's got their beer on tap, and I'm just like, oh, it's like I'm supposed to be here. I love the pubs in Castle Combe. There's a gorgeous little garden that sits. So like a secret little garden that sits behind the Castle Inn in Castle Combe, and if you've got a sun trap on it, that's a very special place to be. Yeah. Amazing in like September sun. And I love the Potting Shed actually in Credwell, which is a lovely place to go. It makes you feel a little bit special. They've just got certain nice things about it.
Yeah.
My mate Jason runs the Ratbone, so I like to go and catch up with him for a pint.
Where's that?
That's in Sherston. And then there's great pubs everywhere. Every year we run the... we run the Cotswold Way Relay, which goes from Broadway Tower to Bath.
Yes,
it's 100 miles, and there's 10 of us who do it. We'll all do a little section each.
Yeah.
And it's always a strategic thing to finish at a good pub.
Yeah.
So that when you've finished your stretch, you can like, nice, right, I'm going to have a pint. And so the last leg I finished was the Dog Inn in next to Chipping Sodbury. I think it's up at Old Sodbury.
Yeah.
And then I've had one in the old spot, which is in Dursley. That's a very good pub. They're everywhere. They're so everywhere. But actually, the best is to go somewhere where you just don't know anybody. And definitely. But sometimes, and it's nice when you that thing where you suddenly it's like, no, we don't take cards here. It's like there are a few still like that.
Scrabble around.
Exactly. So they're all good. But pub, actually, fun enough. Yeah, I mean, But I do feel like I go to less pubs than I used to, and it's such a shame because I spent my childhood working in pubs, and I was a chef and I was a barman in pubs in Castle Coombe, and I've been in lots over the years, and I go less. It's become expensive, hasn't it? I mean, £5 a pint is
it'll be teetotal now.
Yeah, well, you end up going to the supermarket and having a beer at home or with friends or whatever, and that's not the same experience. No, so no, I adore it if I'm in a, you know, you don't have to drink in the pub. It's just not. I will happily, if I'm skint, I will happily order a portion of chips and have lime and sodas and literally spend a couple of pounds in a pub. But I'll sit in the pub with my sketchbook, yeah, and it could be anywhere. I mean, for me, it could be the Smoking Dog, and I like to be in that environment. So it's not necessarily to drink. I'm there essentially scrounging off their Wi-Fi and just, otherwise I'll spend all my time in my office by myself. Yeah, so quite often I'll
need interaction. Totally. So my final question to you is, all the products, all the inventions that you have, what is the one that makes you sort of swell with happiness?
The one that makes
you
swell with happiness.
If you had to choose one, which I know is like choosing your children.
Every Wednesday in Malmesbury, there's a group of runners. I think I mentioned them for the plogging thing earlier, but they come running through town and they're the Abbey Flyers and they must wear about 30 of my Million Mile Lights between them. So they've all got the lights on.
Yeah.
Now they don't know that I'm watching them. They, I'm not watching them, like I follow them everywhere they go. No, not at all. But the for me, it's like a human powered art installation. They don't know that they're doing it. It just gives me such a buzz to go, that was my idea. They run, it's their energy, their light, their power, their whole thing, it's keeping them safe. That's a very special experience for me, and that makes me feel very proud every time I see them run by and go, oh, that's my idea, that is.
Yeah.
And it's not like I've sold, they've all discovered the story, and I know I'm local, but they've it works.
They wouldn't be telling each other about it if it didn't work.
Totally. So that's a verification that, I've got to stick with it.
Yeah. No, I said that was the last question. I've got one more.
Okay.
What have you got? And it's already top secret, but have you got anything, are you already thinking about the next thing that you want to
There create? Are always ideas, and I'm trying to be a little bit more, as I say, the ideas don't belong to me. I have this invisible antennae on my head, but you've got one as well.
Yeah.
And it all depends on how tuned we are as instruments as to how much we pick up on things, and we're all skewed in different ways. You might be picking up stories, or and I might be picking up different ideas, but we're all picking up creative things and processing them through. So ideas just keep coming to me, as I say, like a fruit tree. And what I realised is that there's no point holding on to all these fruits. Sometimes I should pop them out there.
Yeah.
And so I had one a couple of nights ago. Someone was talking about the fact that when your phone is on, someone verified my idea to me. So I'll have ideas, but I don't always know whether they're any good. And then I saw this conversation on Twitter that someone was saying, even when your phone is on, even though you're not looking at it, if it's in your immediate surroundings, you're being distracted by it without even realizing it. Just the idea that it might give you a notification. And I think that, so I had this idea a couple of days ago. It was basically like a toaster, but imagine for one piece of toast, but it's not a toaster, and it's an inanimate kind of cube, but you slot your phone into it, and when your phone's gone into it, it'll take half an hour for it to come out. That's it, right? And it's just so to encourage us to stop looking at screens, basically.
You meant that for fridges as well. So.
to stop going in the fridge. No, it's true. It's this is the thing. It's technology is amazing, but our behaviour with it, technology has increased at such an exponential rate, but wisdom is a really slow process to kind of acquire. And I find it all the time that I'm... I look at my phone because I've got a certain notification that's come, and then I see something else, and I'm distracted by something else. And I find it happening to myself all the time, this distraction.
Yeah.
So no, it's not. I don't
and that
think
fear
it's
of not you particularly, but one fear of missing out. You know, if you're not checking all the time, that something must be happening.
Totally,
there never is.
No, there never is, and the important thing is happening in connections.
In
the little conversations between people in pubs and communities
absolutely.
And all those things. And but yeah, so I was. I was telling myself, I need to make myself a sin bin for my phone and for my kids as well. Because, but it's almost like, but if I take the phone off the kids, then they're like, oh, you've got the phone. Yeah, but if I just dropped it in this thing, when there it is, it's gone for half an hour. Yeah. Do something else.
Yeah.
So I
and
might.
And they probably wouldn't want it, would they?
And they probably wouldn't want it because they're distracted. They've done something else because it wasn't an option. Yeah. And so, I don't know, might do that. I like this whole space of meditation and calm. And especially for. This is why I love the Uplift Project. Is especially for, and so I can see myself just growing things that encourage meditation and calm and kind of like non-thinking, but that aren't phone related.
Yeah.
And really, we're spoiled here. When I'm at my house, I live at the Silk Mills, and I can look out the window and I've got the Avon flowing outside. Yeah. I don't need an uplift. I've got a river to look at. Yeah, I'm incredibly privileged in that respect. But it's almost. I look at the cities and all the stress and all the tension held within those places, and it's almost like it's almost to me it's obvious that you don't have enough nature, and so I really can see myself working in a space that's about creating things that encourage flow and evoke a positive mindset, but for people who perhaps don't have access to nature, I think that's a thing.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
That's my pleasure.
You,
I could have talked to you for the whole
afternoon.
Know. Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping you might take up this idea of doing your own podcasts.
Well, I'd like to. I've got so many creative heroes that I think I do. I like the idea that creativity could be a superpower, and I think that I might be inspired by you. So,
good.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Tom, very much.